Hello, this is David Rovics with another episode of Discussions with David, a live stream broadcast I've been doing every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday during the pandemic, as long as I can't travel and play music for a living anymore. I'm also broadcasting on Mondays and Tuesdays. Mondays I host Pandemic Open Mic Mondays, which anyone with a song, poem, or rant is encouraged to sign up for at davidrovics.com/POMM. Tuesdays, I host Fifth Estate Live, produced by Peter Werby. All of these live stream broadcasts start at 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. GMT every weekday, and you can find them both live and in archived form on the Facebook pages of Popular Resistance, KABU Community Radio, and my own Facebook pages and channels on YouTube, Periscope, Twitch, VK, and LinkedIn. If you go to davidrovics.com or search on any podcasting platform for the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can also find these programs in audio form soon after they're broadcast live. Another place you can find the broadcasts, along with lots of free content, as well as content reserved only for patrons, such as my 16-part audio memoir, is at patreon.com/davidrovics. That's also where you can support my various musical and non-musical efforts at Popular Education. Today, I'm happy to have Margot Black back on the show to catch up on what's been happening since I had her on last, which was way, way back in April, an eternity ago. Margot teaches math at Lewis and Clark College. She's most well known around here as the founder of Portland Tenants United, an organization that has been instrumental in winning some important victories on behalf of the renters in Portland, Oregon. Those of us who have been on the losing side of the class war here and throughout this country for a very long time. She recently made an attempt at running for the Portland City Council, just as the pandemic lockdown took hold and her kids came home from school and never went back. Margot, welcome to back to my live stream show.
Thanks, David. Nice to be here. One question before we start. I don't teach at Lewis and Clark anymore. I haven't taught math since spring of 2018. That's all.
Carry spring on. Of 2018. Okay. Oh, wow. I'm way behind this time. Have you been surviving since then?
It's been a complicated odyssey I left my job in after the spring semester of 2018 as a kind of an indirect result of a hit or of a call out article that was released that January. I was able to use unemployment and a small severance package. I've been kind of weaving. I had a little employer funded retirement account that Lewis and Clark very generously funded for me. And that's what I've kind of been draining in.
Were you forced to leave?
We should not talk about this on the air because there were some signed. So.
Oh, yeah. Those kinds of agreements, which is, really.
Yeah. But it's very hard to be when somebody Googles you and sees that you are a racist white supremacist. It's very hard to stay in a non-tenured position at a liberal arts college that is facing, a lot of the same pressures to respond to, institutionalized white supremacy and racism that everybody else is. And even if they didn't feel that pressure, it's, teaching math to underprepared freshmen is what we call them. It was, lower level math, the very high stress, high anxiety. When those freshmen come in, they already don't want to be there. They've had lots and lots of problems with their previous math experience. And then you have college level expectations and they're frustrated. This is a really common power struggle. And then they, there's this, whose fault is it? Am I the bad teacher? Are they, struggling because of their own learning habits? And then they go online and see that I am a known villain. And then we've kind of I've lost the classroom for the term. And that's, that's a dynamic that makes teaching on, in the future for me, it's kind of a non-starter.
I I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to talk to was about how actively you are trolled online by people who want to vilify you and Portland Tenants United for their for the organization's any association with you. And it's every time pretty much that I ever mention your name or mention Portland Tenants United on any social media platform, I am attacked for it, and this is the last time it happened, and it's typically it's by anonymous people. They never want to identify who they are,
who accuse me of failing to be accountable and transparent.
Right. Well, they're making generally unsubstantiated allegations, and like the last one, it was they were quoting from an article that was not published in any kind of a journalistic enterprise. You know, it's a medium. Everybody knows what medium is these days, and that's just a blog site. There's no editors involved. It was an anonymously written article on a blog, which was then presented by this person.
That authored by one of the co-chairs of Portland Democratic Socialists of America, because that's what leadership of the Democratic Socialists do, is take down socialists in our community.
So these anonymously written posts are being written by people that you probably know who they are, and they just don't want to say who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I know most of them, but I do. I mean, it's pretty easy to pick out the identity of a lot of the anonymous ones, but then there are others where, and whether it's comments or posts or whatever, or emails. I got an email from, shortly after the more recent articles were published, telling me, like, here's what's going to happen. You're canceled forever. You're done in this town. And that particular email was also signed anonymously as Atlas Not Shrugged, I think, a riff on Rand's article. That I'm pretty sure is, I mean, I do have several landlord trolls, and of course they're all anonymous too. And I don't think that the group of people frothing at the mouth to take me down from the left care at all about who they work with. and so they absolutely have, empowered the landlord trolls who have definitely infiltrated that group to help. Which I just, it's like, hey, if you're working with, like, literally, the number one enemy of capitalism, maybe you're on the wrong side of this, there are a lot of people I don't like in the left, but I don't, go after them publicly and take them down because I don't want to do the state's work for them.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of people who are like of my, parents' generation who were very active as young adults in the 1960s. And I hear from so many of them who were really in the thick of the movement at the time, which was, as people hopefully are aware, was a very large movement for in the last few years of the 60s, especially, and a very fraught with lots of possibility, much like people feel this moment in history is. And what so many of them will say, that the worst thing that ever happened to them was not the police brutality, but all the backstabbing. Mm-hmm. And, I think people who are looking around today at all the protests, and, people are well aware of how much police brutality is going on. And, we can say with quite a bit of certainty that the police were just as brutal in the 60s. They just maybe didn't have quite as much, military equipment back then. But all this backstab, I mean, what strikes me is how all the corporations and the politicians can all line up and say, we support Me Too, we believe Black Lives Matter. But then when it comes to actual implementation, if women matter, then what are we going to do about it? If Black Lives Matter, then, how about the cost of housing? If women matter, how about all those women with children who are the most affected people in this housing crisis? And then when you talk about that, suddenly you're attacked. I mean, just, you can put up a, you can put up on telephone poles anywhere in this city. You can put up anything about the Me Too movement and anything about Black Lives Matter, and it's not going to get taken down. But if you put up something about rent, it'll get taken down immediately or within a few hours anyway.
Because it's actually a challenging the system. I mean, and that's not. I mean, yeah, Black Lives Matter and Me Too, absolutely. But they're abstract, right?
Yes.
And you know, it's not a demand, and so it's a statement. And you're right; they'll be left out because it's a statement. It's easy to agree with that, right? Who, you know? I mean, I'm going to say who's going to say Black Lives don't matter? But of course, Trump has made that an okay yeah. to say. But it does not take any courage or bravery or hard policy work or sacrifice to say Black Lives Matter, to agree and affirm with that, right, as a corporation or a politician. But yeah, then actually putting the pedal to the metal. I mean, we saw that with Wheeler and police reform, right, when he ran 4 years ago. And every time there's any event, he'll go up to the mic and try to say the right things, right? But then and you get the sense that he's trying to express his just personal horror over how bad things are. But then, okay, well, there's some real concrete, low-hanging fruit you can do about it, Mayor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's like
half the budget of the city is the police, right? What is it? We spend 40% or something.
Yeah.
And he's the police commissioner and they're using all this tear gas and he can express sympathy, but
it's the weirdest thing. I mean, this is something that's been disillusioning for me since I really got involved I really got involved in local politics 5 years ago. I would say that I really started paying close attention to, whether promises were being kept or whatever during the Obama presidency. Because just like I think so many other people, we were like, oh God, thank God this guy, we finally won, everything's going to be better. And then it was such a disappointment. And I remember at the time thinking there has to be guns trained on his kids' heads. That's the only way he could be failing so much to deliver on these things that I know he believes in his heart. My thinking about it. And it's still, I maybe am cut from a different cloth. I'm not even trying to be self-congratulatory here. I'm just, I'm very authentic. I just don't say things as a politician or whatever that I don't mean and think and feel and have every intention to try to push, right? So I'm how can you say one thing and then do another? It just really confuses me.
It's so confusing, isn't it? And Obama was just doing that all the time.
People in the background being we will kill your kids if you don't do exactly what we say. It's
right?
That's the only possible explanation. Because otherwise it just doesn't make any sense,
It's hard to figure. Yeah. I think one friend of mine who I was a long time ago trying to figure out why this happens so often. And he said, he thought it was more about cynicism, that politicians are all very cynical and then they think, not all, but the vast majority of them are very cynical. And they think that at least they're doing a less bad job than somebody else would do. So Obama had the same bunch of Goldman Sachs bankers advising him as Bush did. But I guess he figures, he's not going to take all their advice quite as much as Bush did. But in fact, it was under his administration after the financial crisis, which of course he's not responsible for. But after the financial crisis, this is when the rents in this country and the cost of buying houses as well for housing generally just went through the roof, and it was already a terrible crisis. And it's not coincidental, I guess, that it was after the financial crisis because all this consolidation was going on. I'm only just kind of starting to figure out what's been going on. I've been just living through it, trying to pay the rent all this time as my rent has gone up by 250% in this city. But
never let a good crisis go to waste, right? I mean, I think we say that on the left in terms of mobilizing to try to push through the change we need. And I think the ruling class absolutely recognizes when, oh, whoops, did we accidentally let the global economy crumble. Well, how can we make as much money as possible and all the resulting poverty and, you know, collapse?
That's the, but now this time it seems they're scared.
And re-rent them to people.
Right?
Yes.
But yes. They're scared this time, aren't they? It's a, it seems a bit different, doesn't it? Does it seem different to you than it did back in 2008? Because, I mean, back then it's like, okay, we need to bail out the banks was seeming, seemed to be the basic idea. But now it's like, they're scared. I mean, we're looking at like 20%. I mean, NPR was just saying there's possibility of as many as 20 million evictions in September in this country.
Like, if they're not scared, then...
They're really foolish.
Right. And I mean, when I think about the 20 million evictions and the joblessness and everything, I'm like, the dam's going to break, right? Like, at some point, you lose the numbers. I mean, the only reason that capitalism can continue to, you know, continue at all in this exploitative cycle is if you, you keep the most oppressed sort of small enough, right? And you can continue to have narratives that make it their responsibility. They didn't work hard enough, made bad choices in life, whatever. But when you have a critical mass of people who are counterexamples to that by every stretch of the definition and are losing their homes or going hungry or, you know, you're going to lose. Right. And so 20 million, how they can't evict 20 million people. They just can't. I mean, it's just not like they can't do it. Like what?
Right.
Then what? Then we have 20 million vacant homes that nobody can afford. And that's what, you know, I'm like, look, you guys, y'all like to say it's whatever the market will bear. If you don't like it, you know, move to a cheaper city or move to the suburbs or get a smaller place, right? Like you don't deserve to live in like this nice, fancy, cultured city if you don't work hard enough or whatever, okay? Whatever the market will bear. I mean, I think that even pre-COVID, there are, it's like, is the market bearing this? You know, every time I drive down the street, there's another like, you know, homeless tent village being set up. Like what does it mean for the market to bear it? Right. But if 20 million people are being evicted because they can't pay the rent, well, I mean, then the market, like that's, when does the rent just come down?
Right. And what's going to make that happen? I mean, if they don't just,
do we need to go through this big musical chairs situation where we pull 20 million chairs out and then are like, all right, now put them back. And all those other people that, where were they living before, are now going to move into those? No. Now you're going to lower the rent and let all those same people move back in. I mean, you have to. It's just the numbers don't, I don't know. It's a boggling moment. And I'm just kind of waiting to see we all have to just wait and see what's going to happen, right? Because it's like.
Because there's too many unpredictable aspects. Like right now, we don't know when is the $600 extra in unemployment money that tens of millions of people are now getting. Those who are lucky enough to manage to get through to unemployment, unlike me, for example, I get a busy signal every time I call. But it's been three months now. But there's so many other people in a much worse situation who have no other source of income, who have been waiting to try to get on unemployment for 3 months and selling everything they own in the meantime, borrowing as much as they can, maxing out their credit cards. But then those who are getting the unemployment, that's going to run out presumably at the end of this month. Of course, if that changes and they renew it, then that changes the entire formula, right? Because we don't know what's going to happen in September because we don't know how many more trillions the Congress might spend to try to forestall the inevitable.
And here's what I love. I'm like, if they have enough money to give us, you know, I mean, they're just going to have to extend the unemployment, right?
Unless they want a revolution or a civil war or whatever.
So probably they don't. And so they're going to extend the unemployment. But, you know, what have we learned in the last few months? We've learned that the government has enough money to give us, you know, $1,100 a month or what. I mean, that's what it is in Oregon if you've got max unemployment and the $600. I'm on SNAP, and they increased my benefits to I was $125 before because I was getting child support and taking draws off my retirement. And then they increased me to $509 just because COVID. And so, you know, why couldn't they give me, I needed $509 before, but you know, now I get it, right? So it's like they have, the resources are there. You know, we figured out how to do a lot of, you know, meetings and school and stuff online. Not that that is a, you know, perfect. I'm just saying we've come up with so many solutions that we didn't think possible months ago. You know, the landlords haven't gotten the rent and they haven't like been struck down by lightning. You know, the houses haven't like crumbled to the ground. Like the global economy has stopped and the resources that we've been heretofore told like don't exist or are scarce have been deployed. And how are they going to take that away and be like, there's no more money? You know, I mean, it's like the Portland says, okay, we would open summer camps or the community centers or whatever in a socially distanced environment, but now there's no money because COVID and maybe the police. I don't know if it's police overtime. It's like, what do you mean there's no money? You know, I mean, like you find money for everything you need whenever you need it. And now you just don't have money for parks, right? Like, yes, yeah. You have the money. Like you can't lie to us anymore.
The cat's out of the bag, right? Which is, yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody who's watching on YouTube is wondering what SNAP is. And that's what we used to call food stamps,
Yes. Which
is sort of assistance from the federal government that comes nowadays in the form of a debit card where you can, but you can only spend it on food.
Yeah, supplemental nutrition assistance program.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So I am also trying to get unemployment. I actually qualify for the unemployment extension because my benefits ran out, you know, after a certain day or before, I don't know, last year. I didn't think I qualified, but I do. And so I applied and...
How's that going?
Well, I applied 4 weeks ago, because it took me a while to know. And it was really funny because when I first applied, it said, you should have received a letter saying that you might qualify. And I was like, oh no, did I throw away that letter? Like, does it have some secret website or pin on it or whatever? Anyway, I finished the application and then that day I got a letter in the mail. So now we're talking like 3 months after COVID started that says you might qualify for extended unemployment benefits. And I was like, oh, okay, I got the letter. Like literally the day I submitted my application.
They should send these letters to the morgue, you know? I mean, I know, like, right? How are people, where are people supposed to have survived after 3 months? No exactly. Income.
And so I have been waiting to find out. And I, you know, when I applied for unemployment last year, it was actually a pretty efficient system. And I submitted my application online and I found out right away whether I qualified. And then I start, you know, it worked pretty well. In this case, it's the not regular unemployment, it's the extension. And so you have to apply this whole different way. And I literally have no evidence at all that my application has been received or any, I mean, there's just nothing.
You didn't even get an automated email in response?
Nope, nothing. And so I've submitted my application in 13 weeks of claims. I have nothing. No idea if it's just like lost in the digital ether or I can't call because it's busy. And I'm just like, I don't, you know, at some point, maybe there'll be a big direct deposit for like
maybe
on my bank account.
I mean, it's just like, it's the system is so broken. It's and it's just like, I mean, for people, I think, you know, probably anybody watching who's from the US is, this is old news, but these programmers, I mean, the employment department is working off of programming languages that nobody learns anymore. Like they can't get enough people in, enough programmers who are in their 80s out of retirement who know Fortran.
This is tough for me as a socialist because I'm like, tax the shit out of the rich and, you know, everybody gets a, you know, a state or a public job, you know, to like help deploy all of the benefits and social services and, you know, everything we need. Like I'm pro state in that sense.
Right.
And And then I'm like, but you guys, you have no 50-year-old tech. Like, what? Why? Why?
But I think that's been intentional to underfund the employment department for decades so that they never really have the opportunity to be modernized and upgraded. And then they always, I mean, they it seems like it's supposed to be so such a mess that you can't really navigate it. I mean, I look at this website and I just can't imagine.
And revenue have another computer system and the DMV have another one and that human services have another. I mean, it just seems like it's like we sat around and we're like, how could we be as inefficient and as wasteful with our money and processes as possible?
That's what it seems like. Yeah. I believe that's all intentional. Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. And then I'm like, okay, well, now the Republicans on the other side talking about, you know, no government wastes its money and too much in taxes. I'm like, I mean, you're not wrong. But you're wrong. We still need that tax money. We just need it to not go to hiring 80-year-olds out of retirement to, you know, figure out 50-year-old programming language issues. And instead it needs to go to giving, you know, more people childcare and food and education, you know. So anyway.
You know, the health and safety, you know, OSHA, the health and safety department, even before Trump, they were so thoroughly defunded that they had the budget to be able to visit one workplace in the United States once every 29 years on average. So, I mean, if you're running a factory and you know that the government oversight is so non-existent that it basically only exists on paper, then, you know, of course you can do whatever you want to it. It seems to be the same with every other government agency in this country. They're all just designed to be broken so that we can then say, oh, look, government doesn't work. We need everything run by private corporations, you know.
No, there should be a nonprofit that does it instead. We should have a nonprofit that is grant funded and government funded and where all the workers can make half as much and spend most of their time just applying for grants and coming and visiting us in the streets and telling us that our tactics are too radical and that we just need to calm down and work with all the stakeholders to make sure that the bosses are happy. Because otherwise, they're going to take their workplaces and their jobs and go somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. As if that would be such a big problem if they went somewhere else, then we might be able to afford to live in this city, because actually most people in this city do not work for Intel.
Nope. It's true. So, yeah, I have a lot of, like, anger at the political moment right now. It just feels like such a moment, you know, and there's just so much opportunity for us to seize on and take power and educate the masses around, like, the fact that the emperor doesn't have any clothes and hasn't forever. And I just feel like we aren't doing a really good job at that.
But it's a really, it's the sort of things that have been happening just in the past couple of months kind of leave the sort of more established little groups of people who have been trying to make a difference kind of in the dust in a way. I mean, it's like we got massive stuff happening, and it may be largely sort of all over the place in terms of the focus, but it's gotten a lot of attention from the political elite. I mean, if anybody wants to say that having a good riot in over 100 cities at the same time doesn't get their attention, you know, you're either wrong.
Thanks for saying that, because sometimes my cynicism overrides the my ability to, like, recognize and acknowledge the good stuff. And I mean, I totally agree. Like, in terms of, like, what, you know, what do protests do? What's the point? You know, protesting doesn't do anything. We've definitely seen that is not true, right?
Yeah. We could have written a million letters to your congressman and it would never get the Congress to start talking about defunding the police. And you wouldn't be hearing it.
That was probably the most remarkable thing to me, that, like, abolish the police, which seemed, you know, I mean, it was a new concept to me a couple of years ago, as a fairly, you know, I mean, I've always been as progressive as I knew the, you know, as far as I could see the bubble, you know, and it's certainly, you know, my Overton window has shifted. But it just seemed like, you know, be more likely to seize private property than abolish the police, you know? And then overnight it went to like mainstream media has like abolished the police in its headlines. And it was, that's remarkable. I mean, just the fact that it's become a conversation and people are asking like, what does defund the police mean? And the police have been really helpful in going out and continuing to show.
Right. This is why the police suck. Let me show you again. We'll kill somebody.
Read the room.
It's just amazing.
It is. You know, it's no, like, you must just be living in La La Land thinking that this is, like, that you're going to get away with this right now. So we have, I mean, we really have accomplished amazing things, but it's frustrating because it does seem like there was, you know, a big, huge push and we got, we have started conversations that were not even being had before. And both on abolishing the police and even just systematic and institutionalized racism and white supremacy, which is, you know, really good. I mean, I have family in Utah. It's where I'm from. And I just found my biological father in 2018.
Oh, wow.
Through Ancestry DNA. So I grew up not having any father figure at all and not knowing who he was, not knowing his name, not knowing anything. And in finding him, I also found a sister and a brother, and now they're my family. It's really awesome.
Wow. Yeah. Are they in Utah?
They're in Utah. And my sister just was actually here a few days ago visiting. And they're, so it's a big Mormon family. My little clan is like LDS in name, and kind of some of them are more Mormon than others. Some of them are definitely more conservative than me for sure, but also not as far right as they go. However, my dad's cousin, I think this is really sort of fun and funny in a way. My dad's cousin is the Senate majority leader for the Republican Party in Utah. and donated to my campaign $50.
All right.
They, you know, so they consider themselves, you know, racially progressive. My sister has a stepdaughter who has a black partner and a black half black child, and they've, you know, not, I mean, I'm not saying like they have black friends, so therefore everything's okay. I'm just saying they've been exposed to this and have had to do a lot of their own, you know, thinking and analysis on it, whatever. And I was going somewhere with this.
It's, I'm glad this happens to other people.
But what's, yeah, oh, me. Yeah.
The brain fart phenomenon, you know?
What's been interesting is, you know, I went down there last summer and was talking a lot about, you know, the call out culture has really affected me and my activism in a lot of ways. And I was talking to my sister about it, and to her, it just, I mean, it's all like using words like colonialist, or colonizer, and institutionalized white supremacy, even this kind of cultural norm now of being like, I am, as a white person, I am racist. And I know that I benefit from white supremacy, you know, that kind of like that analysis, right? It all, you know, she is a thinking, open-minded person all the way. No criticism there, but is still like, that's like insane. You know, like, what does it mean? And all I'm trying to do is point out the gulf between the sort of, you know, lefty, milieu and our vocabulary and concepts, and then like everybody else out there who in theory we need to kind of start to like bring together anyway.
But that's been changing, huh?
That's a thing. Fast forward a year, and I just saw her last week, and she was reading How to Be an Anti-Racist. And we were talking about systemic and institutional white supremacy, and it was just a whole different conversation, and it was just
something phenomenal else
to me that it had like pierced at that level, you know?
Yeah. All of a sudden, just since the killing of George Floyd, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which is 10 years old, is a bestseller again. And that's really, it reminds me of after 9/11 when everybody started buying Qurans, which I mean, struck me as a sort of it's groping in the dark, but clearly a lot of people were trying to understand what was happening here and doing their best. I mean, the New Jim Crow is a much better book.
Yes, I'm glad they're reading that one.
Yeah.
What makes a city? No.
Mike Davis or no. There's a lot of good ones though. Owning the Earth.
It's one that I always keep right next to the New Jim Crow. Oh, The Color of Law. That's what it is. The Color of Law. And that helps really show how so many of our laws, but also like our urban planning policies and, you know, the way codes and charters are written, everything, how it has been devised to just systematically keep a, you know, racialized, poor, exploited, powerless, black working class, impoverished class. I'm glad they're reading those books. I would like, since we are like on live TV, I would like to be a white woman who says publicly that Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility is the last fucking book that anyone should be reading right now.
Oh yeah, I haven't read it. But it's you read it? It's no good?
I'm hate reading it right now. Basically, I think it's everything that is wrong with. It's what's kind of causing this toxic call-out culture and what's given it legs, because it's ostensibly written for like any white person who I guess thinks that racism and white supremacy ended in the civil rights era and doesn't like understand what all the fuss is about right now. And I'm trying to think, okay, well, if I had read this book like 10 years ago, it was only written a few years ago, would I get more out of it? I mean, she does a pretty good job of explaining white privilege and different ways that institutionalized white supremacy and racism manifests in our neighborhoods and schools and workplaces. That part is good if you haven't been exposed to it before and if you don't, you know, you really need it kind of spelled out for you, and plenty of people do. But in terms, and I'm not all the way through it yet, so I can't say exactly what her prescriptions are, but I basically, you know, most of the kind of liberal racial justice warriors right now are kind of using her book as the Bible. It proposes a very, very, very individualized prescription to anti-racism of just this never-ending self-reflection, self-flagellating, self-accountability. And look, white people and white women, we have lots of work to do. And they're, you know, the racism did not end in the 60s. White privilege is real. Institutionalized white supremacy and racism is real. As white people, do we benefit from that? That is all very real. Do we have internal and implicit biases that affect our behavior and react? All of that is true. And I can, you know, self-reflect day in and day out until the day I die. And it's not going to make anyone's rent cheaper. It's not going to keep, you know, any cops from killing Black people. And really what it is it's a very capitalist solution. And it's basically the, you need to hire the Robin DiAngelos of the world to come to your organization, to come to your workplace, to teach you about how you're privileged and teach you to feel a sufficient amount of guilt around that. Just so you can be more aware, and then they move on to the next workplace, and there's no prescription, and there's no collective responsibility, and I feel like it's very And to me, I think this is our one of our biggest struggles is capitalism is based on this individualism, right? You know, you work hard, make good choices, and you too can be anything you want, right? You can have the American dream, you can be CEO of your own corporation, God of your own planet. It's the Mormon Church. And you don't really have a responsibility to the collective. Maybe your family, I mean, that's sort of the extent of our collectivism anymore, but you don't feel any responsibility for, you know, society or that, you know, and that is that's really different from healthier societies and cultures and economic systems, right? Like if we do want to move towards socialism, we need a different social contract that says that, you know, we care about that, you know, frail, sick person, even though, you know, we worked hard and made good choices in life, right? I spend a lot of time thinking.
No, I'm thinking about this a lot. We can change the social contract, but as we do that, we also can look at our internal biases and look at how we white people have grown up from birth, thinking that we're better than other people, and we can understand that and understand how it's affected our sense of superiority, and by the same token, how Black and brown people have been raised with the same message that they're inferior to us. And, you know, this affects everybody so profoundly, but none of that's going to change until the structure changes. In this city of Portland, the average Black family in the United States cannot afford a 2-bedroom apartment in this city on what the average Black family makes. Uh-huh. This is a structurally racist city to the core.
So first of all, if we're going to talk about individual responsibility for that, then I want Robin DiAngelo out there telling every privileged white person who owns a home to sign the deed over to a Black person, right? I mean,
we're going to solve it that way, right? But that's what isn't going to work, because most white people, if they own a house, they only own one.
Build the movement on individual guilt, right?
Yeah.
And you've got to tell individuals how to make real sacrifices to offset that guilt, right? Mm. You know, me just sitting and feeling guilty all day and all night is it's a perfect prescription, because it doesn't challenge the system, right? Mm. It's not asking anything from our politicians. It's not asking anything from our corporations, except to spend $40,000 to bring Robin DiAngelo in to give a workshop for a week, right? But it's not asking for real systemic change. Oh, you know, put more people of color on your board or on your, sure. I mean, and again, like, the lack of diversity, 100% a problem, right? But if you don't talk about class, if you don't talk about systems and structures, you bring in, you know, Ben Carson's to sit on your board.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And then, so first of all, Robin DiAngelo, she just completely ignores class, just completely. Just a total erasure there. And I know that's sensitive, especially right now, like class reductionism, and it's, you know, we on the left, I think we have a responsibility to figure out the right way to have that conversation that isn't alienating to people of color and women who feel like their struggles are being erased.
Well, if you listen to Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Economic Rights Campaign, or you listen to Cornel West or so many other very prominent voices from African America, you can hear a hell of a lot about class. They'll start talking about class right away, because class and race is completely, completely intertwined. You cannot separate these things in this country. Right. It's impossible.
Right. And then the other big problem with it, and I think another really big problem with our movement right now, and that is, again, sourced at this kind of white guilt fuel for it right now, is that it really, I mean, I think of successful movements as being an outcome or an output of shifts in power, right? And seizing power from those who have it, and using our, you know, newfound power to create the world that we want, right? Like when we, you know, Portland's Relocation Assistance Ordinance. I know that your viewers don't all know what that is, but big deal in 2017, kind of unprecedented. By the way, it just got held up by the appeals court.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So this might go to the Supreme Court. They're trying to get it shot down by the Supreme Court if they can manage it.
Yeah, so appeals court said, nope, not rent control. It's fine, which was great. That just happened 2 days ago. But that wasn't like, the landlords or the ruling class letting us have, you know, some housing security. That was a hard fought. That was because of our power. We won that, right? We took that and we got that from our own power. Robin DiAngelo in her White Fragility book, her power analysis is totally different. And so one of her examples is Jackie Robinson and breaking the race barrier to become a player in the major leagues. Now, I haven't independently gone back and revisited this history recently. I do remember in school learning about it. And it's not like I grew up in a bastion of progressiveness in Salt Lake City, Utah. I probably even learned about it when I was in an elite private school in Salt Lake. That was my early childhood, was in an elite private school. And I remember it being like a win for the, you know, Black rights and the movement, right? That Jackie Robinson was able to get onto the major leagues, right? That was a fight and that was a win. That was a victory. And that was, you know, it was a new day in town, right? Mm. And Robin DiAngelo describes it as so I guess there was a headline that from the past where it says like Jackie Robinson, I'm saying that right? All of a sudden I'm like, is that the right
Jackie Robinson? Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good. Jackie Robinson, you know, breaks race barrier to play in the major leagues or whatever. And she says that makes it sound like he was finally good enough to play with the whites, right? Like Blacks weren't good enough baseball players until then. And she said, instead, we should rewrite the headline as whites finally allow Blacks to play baseball. And what she's trying to, her case is showing that it wasn't about finally Black people being strong enough and good enough. It was about whites finally letting them. And she's trying to show that whites have had that power and that supremacy. Now, yes, whites had power and supremacy, but it wasn't whites letting him. It was whites losing, you know, the white supremacy losing that battle, right? And it might sound pedantic, but when we use the words let or allow, it's empowering. You know, and I'll never forget in the early days of PTU, you know, I'm a woman and I am not a particularly shy, mild-mannered woman, you know, and I just say what I want to say. And there was a fella in early days of PTU who was also around the table. And after he left, he made a comment to somebody that said, the only reason he let me take up as much space as I did is because I was a woman. And I was like, let me? Who put you in charge? Like, you didn't let me do anything. I took up space because I have power and ideas, and I took that space. I didn't ask for your permission, and you didn't grant it. You know, in fact, that's why you quit, because you couldn't manage me. You know, and so what I'm trying to say is that it denies the power of movement building. What Robin DiAngelo has done is she's made it sound like all victories have been won because whites have let Black people win, you know, and really, no, it's been because Black people have risen up and seized power. And to the extent that they weren't, you know, that those victories weren't as full and complete as they should have been is because of, you know, the FBI coming and slaughtering the Black Panthers and whatnot. Which shows you right there, they weren't letting anything happen, right?
They were actively trying to suppress the movement to had some success in spite of that.
And really the more general thing here is that this hyper-focus on, and again, there's a balance here because we can't, you know, color blindness is not the answer, but this hyper-focus on institutionalized white supremacy and white guilt and all of the racism, white supremacy that has been that's baked into the air we breathe and the water we drink and everything we do. because the conversation is you know, so much about that right now, it's really erased so much of Black history. And I just you know, last week I was having a conversation about just, I can't even remember if it was Black revolutionaries here in America or other revolutionary movements in Africa and Latin America. We never get taught about ever, right? You just never learn about them in school. But even in my like socialist radicalization, I have spent, you know, for every 100 hours that I have spent talking about how, you know, how bad white people are. And again, I'm not going reverse racism, okay? But for 100 hours that I have spent being, you know, unpacking my white supremacy and white privilege and focusing on how bad white people are, I have, you know, spent 1 hour learning about Black history and Black revolutionaries. And not because of what I'm seeking, that's just like the conversations that are happening online and in the streets and everywhere else. Like, we're not, you know, we're not learning how Black movements have won before. We're just yelling at, you know, at each other in the streets about whose tactics are better or whatever. And just, you know, doing a lot of, you know, race shaming and, you know, guilt. And it's really, it's what causes this call out culture. And, you know, this is nuanced too, because I do think there, I mean, really, direct action and activism, so much of PTU's activism relies on call outs, but it relies on calling out capitalists.
Right? Yeah, of course.
And politicians. And so I don't want to just blanket say, you know, that, you know, we have to get rid of call out or cancel culture.
But or backstabbing. Is that what they mean? What do they mean by cancel culture? What is cancel culture? I keep on hearing the term. I don't even know what it means. What is it?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's a new term. I mean, I guess getting canceled means you get deplatformed, you know? For me, you know, I've been deplatformed. I can't get a job. I'm not welcome in organizing spaces. I'm not welcome in, I got kicked out of non-political moms groups because I am not safe.
Because people looked you up online, found stuff that they didn't know, this unattributed nonsense, and then they feel uncomfortable.
Because what we should be doing right now as white people is finding other white people who have sinned or whatever, you know, and identifying them and then showing to everybody that we are good allies by rooting them out. We're not going to tolerate this anymore. You know, the moment has come, and so they're going to, you know, find us and root us out. And again, it's because we haven't been given anything else to do besides self-reflect and find others in need of that self-reflection. And that's the only, you know, then we're like, oh, I did a thing, you know. You know, it's like trapping gophers in the yard or something. And it's like, you finally, I've never trapped gophers. And so I really have no, but I'm searching here for an analogy, right? And then, you know, finally you find one in your trap and like, yes, progress. And, you know, and we don't, I think we're scared of power. We don't know how to occupy our own power. We don't trust power because it has always been used against us. And so when we, you know, when there is power in our movements, and that's what I found so baffling about you know, some of the accusations against me. You know, I've never accepted a dollar for this work. And I need to at some point. I actually can't keep doing it for free because I have bills.
Right.
For a long time, it was just because I was able to balance it with my teaching, and now I have to, you know, figure other stuff out. But like, it's never been about money or power or fame or anything. It's just always been about trying to, like, you know, get at the root of these issues. And people attack me, you know, like, oh, of course she ran for political office. That was her plan all along. And I'm like, to make change. Yes, that's the plan, right? And it's just this trust of anybody who kind of, like, you know, starts to have power. And
you find running for office, did the degree of backstabbing increase because of the effort of running for office compared to other political activities you were engaged in before that?
Well, that's a good question.
Have you become more cynical since running for office? Or?
Yeah. I mean, it was just, so there was a lot of backstabbing that came before running for office.
Yeah. That's why I'm wondering, a hell of a lot before that. So, I mean, did it actually step up when you were running for office?
So one of the things I kind of gambled on when I started running was that so much of the backstabbing has been sort of in the shadows, you know, behind the scenes backstabbing, and not all of it, but most of it from like the last 2 years. And I sort of, you know, because I know that I stand for the right issues, I fight a good fight, I have a track record of winning, I sort of gambled on the people who really have any kind of backstabbing power are people who are, I'd say trained socialists, but not, you know, they're, I gambled on them being like, we hate her, but it would be idiotic to tear her down, you know? Mm. Because if you even read that last call out article, it's really funny because it's like, she's done really good work, or, you know, she did really great on this project, but this one person didn't like her, so she shouldn't run for office. You know, I mean, like, they can't say my politics and my political work and stuff, it's inscrutable, you know? I mean, and from every lens, because I have been out there fighting for comprehensive stuff that actually addresses the systematic racism in our housing and in our zoning and stuff like that. And so my gamble was that they would leave me alone, knowing like, okay, there's just something about that outspoken woman that we don't really like, and we don't know what it is, and we think she's awful, but since we're socialists, it would be embarrassing to come out against her. and I even know that, you know, there were people who hate me and voted for me because I, you know, heard through the grapevine, because they're kind of like, she's still the best we've got. And so that like last minute teardown was, it was really shocking, actually. I don't think it affected.
Was that the anonymously written one that I saw that somebody shared as soon as I, you know, mentioned Portland Tenants United online? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it came out 2 days before the election.
It did. Okay. And anonymously written, published in Medium. And I didn't even read the whole thing because when somebody sent it to me, I looked at where it was published and that it was not credited with anybody. And I figured, okay, it's just probably a rehashing of stuff I've already heard before. And why should I bother reading it? Whoever wrote it doesn't even want to admit who they are.
Well, the funny thing was, is it wasn't really a rehashing because Cameron Witten, who wrote the first one, took his down and said,
right. That's what I heard. But whoever knows that? I mean, I wrote something critical of the Black Bloc 10 years ago, and anything I've ever said that in support of rioting, which I think is generally a fine way to get things accomplished if you want to get the attention of politicians, as we've seen in the past couple of months, it works. But you know, but at the same time, I have been critical of Black Bloc tactics in other situations, in other circumstances in the past. Wrote one article about it. That article got circulated all over the place. And anything I've written since then doesn't get circulated. You know, they pick these things. It's like Martin Luther King's speeches. You know, anytime he talks about love, we all know about the love speech. When none of us have, you know, they never talk about the anti-war stuff and the class war stuff and the poor people's campaign that he was working on before he got shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you're right. So they did know that Cameron had taken it down because in subsequent things there were like, you know, now Cameron's gone all corporate capitalist too, and so we're working together was kind of, I think, the ploy. But no, the new, and what was so disappointing about the most recent call out article, and what is so disillusioning to me about kind of the state of the left right now, at least in Portland, is that it was largely organized by my, you know, by my soon to be ex-husband's new girlfriend.
Whoa.
It was really just about personal, you know, stuff. I'm very disappointed to admit that I am now part of an acrimonious divorce where, I am being construed like, what I want is my husband, Airbox, whatever he is. I want him to be embarrassed that he is now part of an acrimonious divorce where his ex-wife is, you know, crazy and irrational and unhinged. Like, that, it's just like, we're so much better. We're so much more grown up than that, you know? But that's the narrative that she needs to have be true in order for her to feel secure in a relationship, whatever. Even the fact that we're having this conversation right now.
Yeah.
It's like so... And I would
it's so never, sad that we have to.
But that's what fueled that article.
Right, right. And this rent strike effort, folks starting, as much as I totally support the rent strike idea, the idea of supporting a rent strike where the main person forming this group is mostly talking about how much she doesn't like you. It's just completely bizarre. And especially for anybody that's like new to Portland or new to tenant activism to come across this stuff. And I left the group, I think I mentioned to you before, I left the group when there was some post where somebody said something nice about you, and then I clearly that everybody else was saying nice things about you because all their posts got you could see how many of the comments were deleted, and there was like this one post which like nine comments it said there were nine comments but you could only see two of them, so obviously you know there's seven other comments that were deleted. And why were they deleted? Because they were like mine. They were like, why are you dissing Margo? What is the point of this? You know,
that's Olivia, and I don't, you know, I mean, I yeah, no, she's a disaster. She's a disorganizer. I mean, like
a disruptor.
If she's not getting money from the state, you know, for doing, you know, from Interpol or not Interpol, sorry, COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO, like Ward Churchill said, you don't need to be a cop to do a cop's job.
Yeah, she should send them an invoice. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem, you know, here's the problem. Like, it hurts on a personal level, but it's not like I don't need everybody to like me. I don't need a lot of friends or what. Like, that's never what any of this has been about. A lot of people are like, well, just don't listen to them, Margo. You know, there's seven of them. There's 300,000 tenants in Portland, and I get it. That's totally right. And I don't want to let assholes, you know, say mean things about me on the internet, and that to convince me to, you know, give up and crawl into a hole.
But we're human. We have emotions.
Well, there's that. And that's real. And we could spend another hour talking about, you know, my mental health over the last 2 years and sort of the very, very, very real consequences of telling somebody over and over and over that they're a garbage person. Mm. More importantly, and, you know, is that like you said, there's all these new tenant activists reading it and they're trying to figure out what to believe. And, you know, something that really shook me was leading up to that article being published, but before, basically when Olivia started all of the brouhaha in that Facebook group, I had a couple new volunteers on my campaign who were doing really, really great, important work for us that is, you know, they were doing some writing that was really helpful, and they were skilled and talented. They had really good politics and seemed to be kind of outside the fray of like the stupid left. And they were in that group, the PDX Rentstrike group, and they both resigned from my campaign about a week before the end, saying, we didn't know that you had been called out for racism and had failed to be held accountable. And we want to be part of a, you know, an intersectional movement. And it was a nice, like, I respected that they weren't huge assholes about it, but I was like, it was that, you know, they were like, and then you didn't tell us, like, we had to, you know, they found some cached version of Cameron's article because somebody posted it. And then they were mad at me for having not been forthright about that. And I was like, is this like selling a car with a salvaged title? Like, I need to like tell you that I am like a scandalized woman. And whether that is what I actually need to do, the truth of the matter is that it is a liability for people to associate with me right now. And how do you build a movement and build trust and stuff when people are scared to say that they're members of PTU or that they're my friend? And right. then they're at their you know, we just started organizing some new apartment buildings, which were actually self-organizing, and then came to us saying, you know, can you help us, because they want to withhold rent, or they want to make some demands on their landlords about negotiating the rent. Really awesome stuff. And then a week later, they're seeing online about how I am a racist transphobe, people of color won't work with me, you know, I'm emotionally abusive. You know, they're not like, I mean,
they don't know. They just see all this stuff. They don't know. Yeah.
And then do I go talk to them and be like, I'm not really a racist transphobe, right? Like, you can't even say that.
You're immediately put into this position where it's, you know, very, very difficult to sort of defend yourself from this position of being all these baseless accusations, because you have to have, there has to be substance to accusations to be able to defend yourself. So it's right. once they're, baseless, then it's just the accusations do the work all by themselves.
Right. And one of the people who actually signed on to the letter, so here's a fact, you know, tenant organizing is really, really, really hard. There are a lot of, I haven't done a lot of workplace organizing. I'm sure it's this very similar, but unlike a workplace where you at least have to apply and show up every day and do work, otherwise you get fired. There's a little bit of a lower bar in renting. So you have, I guess what I'm trying to say is you have people in rental housing who maybe couldn't get jobs because of the barriers there. And what I'm really trying to say is that these are people who have a lot of mental health issues. They've been crushed by capitalism. They don't, you know, have a lot of trust. You know, there's a lot of issues there, and getting these people to be in solidarity with each other and be kind of disciplined about the plan and trust each other, it's just hard. Okay. And you get backstabbing in these tenant unions, and we've seen lots of that. Well, I had one tenant who I had worked with extensively, and she was like a tenant leader at Holgate Manor. And she, you know, she as well as, you know, she had lots of people have lots of issues. And then fast forward, there was a completely unrelated to tenant organizing issue, like a personal issue that she wanted me to kind of be on her side for. And I was like, well, and she, it was amazing. It was like a flip switched. And she was like, well, I'm just going to tell everybody, you know, if you don't take my side, I'm just going to tell everybody that you're a racist. There's an article showing it. I mean, basically said, like, I'm just going to use that against you. You don't do what I'm asking you to do right now. And then that undoes all of the work we've done. Right. And so I'm basically just, it creates this, you know, this vulnerability. Like, as long as that stuff is out there, it's not, I can like not care what people think about me and go concentrate on like organizing, you know, the working class. And it's absolutely true that if they haven't seen what's online, they don't give a fuck, right? Mm-hmm. What they want is they want to be able to afford their rent. They want to know where they're going to live next year. They want, you know, their heat to work. And they don't want to live in constant fear of their landlord. And then we start that work, and it's a lot of work, and it takes a lot of time, and you're playing this game of chicken with the landlord. And then, you know, an article like that gets blasted, and then the landlords are like, LOL.
You know? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'm sure if it didn't get blasted, then one of the landlords would share it. And
They already do, you know, yeah. And then the tenants, as soon as you have a tenant who has any reason to, not feel like they're getting their needs, whatever, then they bring a copy of that to the next meeting, and it's all undone. And
what's even perhaps more insidious, I would guess, and this is where it's really even hard to even, you know, have any idea of, is how many people don't get involved in the group in the first place because they see an article. Yeah. You know, I mean, because I know, like, from my own experience as a famously supposedly anti-Semitic musician, mm-hmm. You know, if you're critical of Israel, you're going to be denounced as an anti-Semite. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is what people find if they look for me online. So, you know, but most of the time they're not going to bother writing me and, or denouncing me as an anti-Semite. They just aren't going to hire me for their festival.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. No, and that's basically after Cameron's article in early 2018, I was more or less that ended me being asked to speak anywhere, you know, certainly at rallies and marches, but other public events and stuff like that. And I mean, not that I, you know, not that I need to like it, but, I was the only person, you know, really, I mean, you can invite Community Alliance of Tenants and they won't use the word landlord once in the things they say, you know, and meanwhile, we've got a movement talking about wanting to elevate the voices of women and people of color and women leaders. And like, I have been wholesale replaced by cishet white dudes, you know, like as soon as I, like, it was, you know, as soon as Cameron took me down with his 2018 article, Sammy, my cishet white husband, and actually the one who was guilty of some of the things in the article, but wasn't named, he was the one invited to go doing, you know, do the speaking. And it's like, this maybe has something to do with why we don't have more women in leadership. You don't let them get there. You know?
Yeah. And it seems also there's this problem I've noticed of who has the time to be doing this kind of organizing, because first of all, nobody has the time really, but the people who do have the time more than others are people who are not working two jobs. And, you know, I don't know any, I mean, I'd be hard pressed to think of any, I don't know, at least among so many of the people I know in this city, like, I mean, if they're not working like at Intel or something, they're working two jobs, you know, they don't have time to be organizing. Well,
of course. And I mean, that's on purpose, right? That's how we can't organize.
Yeah.
That we have to work constantly so we can't organize. And that, yeah, that's certainly something I've seen in tenant organizing, you know, and just in general, it's hard to get the folks who should be involved because yeah, they have two jobs and three kids and
yeah. I mean, you look at community radio, like who has the time to be having a community radio? I mean, nothing, not to say anything about cable in particular, but just like community radio all over the country. Like it's a lot of people who are retired, you know, they have the time, and it's not like they're trying to promote the voices of the elderly. It's just, right. Who has,
you know. It's just like, I know I'm a white woman and I heard loud and clear in the beginning of my activism, you know, white people only cared when it started affecting them. That is true. You know, I remember the moment where I was like, oh my God, am I going to get priced out of Portland? Like, I never thought that was going to happen to me. And between that and like a landlord, you know, treating me like I was a kid. And I was like, how, why can't you treat me like that? You know? And it was when it started to affect me that I started to fight, and yeah, lots of other white people too. Yeah. And there, you know, the anger from, you know, the Black community about that, totally righteous. I get it. So I have really, like, how do I use my white anger and all the privilege that I get as a white woman with a lot of cultural capital? You know, I mean, I'm very good at code switching. You know, I can be in the streets screaming and I can sit around the tables as a rental services commissioner, you know, and not lose my politics, right? But I can. Mm. I can play both roles. And so I, you know, how do I in good conscience as a white woman kind of be any kind of leader in this movement? And one of the ways I do that is by reminding people that the problem didn't just start, you know, in 2010, that for people of color, we've had a housing crisis, you know, for 300 years. And that, you know, that really try to talk about the systemic issues of it. Eschew home ownership as a solution, because that is like fine, you know, I'm not going to begrudge anybody who wants to go buy a house, but that is a solution that was only ever meant for like, you know, elite, like white landowning males. And then finally, you know, we've kind of allowed a few other classes, but then we have created huge structural barriers to really opening home ownership up to a broader swath of people. So I talk about the history, I talk about the racism, and then when we do policy work, you know, I've prioritized the application and screening, like basically all the ways that keep people from being able to get into an apartment because of credit check and criminal background histories and rental references, all things that disproportionately affect people of color. Anyway, I fight when we write policy. I mean, our fucking rent control policy that PTU was told, if you fight this, it's because, you know, you're privileged white people and don't care about organizing from people of color. Who is protected by limiting rent increases to 10% a year? Yeah. Middle-class renters. Okay.
This city is unaffordable to the average Black family now, and it was, and that was also the case a few years ago, and it's just getting worse. 10% is ridiculous.
And landlords, they still get 1 year to no-cause people. Who do you think get no-cause in their first year? You know, Black single moms, people of color, you know, people with criminal background, whatever. It's like all the people, you know, our no-cause eviction crisis was, it was already about that first year of tenancy, right? Those are the people that have to move year after year after year after year. And our, you know, our statewide nonprofit that's been representing low-income and marginalized tenants for the last 20 plus years. I'm sorry, I am done pretending to be nice about Community Alliance of Tenants.
Yeah, good.
this will be my first official done being nice about Community Alliance of Tenants. I mean, I'm already been canceled, so I have nothing to lose.
Right.
But you know, they were like, if you don't support this bill, then you're racist. And I'm like, dude, this bill doesn't protect any of the people who need this bill the most. Right.
Why do people make such compromises? I mean, I know it's been way more than an hour, but we're on the same point, and it's too much of a big point. But why do people make such compromises? How is it? You don't have to be a math professor to understand that 10% is completely untenable.
Because the nonprofit industrial complex is a tool for neoliberalism, and it is. Because neoliberalism they have completely co-opted identity politics. And so you have, you know, wealthy institutional power funding these nonprofits through their grant foundations. You have institutional power guiding the work because of the funding and because of their membership on the board or their steering committee or whatever. And then you have, they've already, you know, the Democratic Party is the army for them in the halls of power. And you've got our Democratic Party saying, this is the best we can get. You know, this is more than we ever thought possible. And we should all just be so happy. And so then we pass a bill that doesn't actually address, and I don't, the bill still, I mean, look, it's still a big deal. And I'm glad it passed in terms instead of nothing. But I mean, at the time we were being told, by Community Alliance of Tenants, we're gonna come right back and fight to fix it and make it stronger and da 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 da. What happened? The speaker's senior housing policy advisor, who she brought on in order to like do this work, she took a new job. Alyssa Kenny Geyer is resigning. The ED of CAT left. The organizing director left. You are not, there's no, you've not, no. Like that was a big lie. And what it got is, the organization got a great big feather in its cap for passing a sweeping bill. Everybody got their picture taken with Governor Brown and their quote in the New York Times. And, you know, they will be in the history books or whatever. And that is a win for the nonprofit. But the nonprofit has never been accountable, truly accountable to the people on the ground. The nonprofit is accountable to those relationships in that kind of power brokey neoliberal milieu. And that's where PTU and CAT have clashed, is that PTU is accountable to tenants and not the relationships. And when we're told, well, if you do that, you know, this organization's never going to work with you again. It's like, well, that sucks, but that we have to make decisions based on what's best for tenants, us. You know, the people who formed this, and not, you know, what's best for that nonprofit or that executive director. And so I think, again, I know we're well over an hour, but I want to say one more thing. So we have the nonprofit industrial complex out there with people of color who now, and I think a lot of the actual humans involved in the nonprofits, good people, we all want the same things largely. I just think that the Kool-Aid is very strong. Yeah. Very, very strong. So you have these people, lots of people of color and people from other underrepresented groups as the, on the front lines, making it look like this is POC-led organizing, but it's being funded by neoliberal institutions guiding the work and saying what is and isn't possible and what we should and shouldn't be grateful for. And, you know, I mean, Kat, I think, has done more to ruin PTU than any other, than any of the trolls have. Mm-hmm. And so you've got that force that is just out there really, I mean, it's just counter-revolutionary, right? It is just trying to constantly take the temperature on the ground and do whatever is needed to kind of keep things under a low simmer. And then you've got this, you know, kind of what we talked about before, this fear of power on the left and, the ruling class, they are class conscious, they are disciplined, they are trained. I don't know if you've watched, and if you haven't, you really should, and so should all of your viewers, and then maybe we can have a little talk about it later. Mm. Mrs. America on Hulu? I think it's on Hulu. And it's about it's about Phyllis Schlafly. Mm. And the Equal Rights Amendment and like the feminist movement in the basically it's about the Equal Rights Amendment failing to become ratified and how Phyllis
and her opposition to it.
Yeah. And it's a recent series. It is brilliantly, in my opinion, it's brilliantly cast, brilliantly written. First of all, I learned about a whole bunch of feminists that I was just never taught about, and I'm just mad. I'm mad about all the history I learned and all the history that I didn't learn all this other history. And it really kind of centers Phyllis Schlafly, and it's not a right-wing propaganda piece. It's not made by the right wing. It's made by the left. And it's fascinating that they kind of, you know, they really focus on her and they don't demonize or vilify her. And which I think is important because you have to realize that the people on that side, they believe in what they're fighting for, right? And you need to understand that. And you need to understand what their motivations are. And if you just see them as like people who wake up in the morning and are like, how can we fuck the poor? You know, then, you don't really know who you're fighting. Anyway, what's fascinating is it shows that, first of all, the feminists, they just weren't ready for Phyllis Schlafly. And they just did not, they were out-organized by her. But then they had infighting going on, right? They were fighting about whether, about abortion being part of the agenda, about gay rights being part of the agenda. There was distrust. Meanwhile, over here on the right, and really, it's a 6 episodes, maybe 9 episodes. Every episode, it features different characters, but you've got Phyllis kind of there all the time. And it's just showing the organizing she did. And it's brilliant organizing that we should be emulating, okay?
Right.
I have long said the Mormons are the best organizers on the planet, and it even shows her like making a call to the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's brilliant organizing and it's disciplined.
Right.
You see like some of the women in her cadre, I can't remember what it was called. And
they're well funded.
Yes. Well, they're well funded, but you see them, she's the spokeswoman and kind of the number one person, you can see them being like, what if we named the group this or like, could I make the speech? And Phyllis is like, no, cause I'm better at it. And this is going to be the name. And I'm not saying that her kind of tyrannicalness is what we should do instead. But the fact is they didn't tear each other apart. They, Phyllis, again, did she make all the right choices? As an organizer on her mission, I'm not going to say, but what she didn't have was people in her group trying to take her down. Whereas on the left, we don't have any discipline and we don't have any loyalty and we are willing to sacrifice the cause.
We believe we're going to lose anyway, most of the time, anyway, right?
So. That's the thing, right? We don't really believe we're going to win. And so it all just becomes cosplay. And we just want to make sure that the, you know, the credits that roll at the end have, you know, certain names on top and not others. And it's, I'm just.
Yeah. And then next time I want to talk about all the different motivations of each member of the Portland City Council. That would be a real geeky conversation for locals, but it would be a fascinating one.
Can we just do this once a week? Can't we just do
a- Yeah, that might be a good idea.
That would be fun, wouldn't it?
There's too much to talk about, definitely. Yeah.
It would be Portland politics. And we'll see you and me talking about...
We could, actually. That's a good idea.
Interesting things to say. And nobody to say them to anymore because I'm
Because you're canceled. Yeah. I want to talk about cancel culture more, but not that we haven't been talking about that, but now I know what it means. I didn't even realize that that's what they're talking about.
I just read a fascinating book. This is the last thing I'll say, then you can cut me off. And I can't remember the name of the author, but it's called Is Shame Necessary? And
right.
I thought it was going to be a book, and I was sort of hoping it would be a book about how awful call-outs are, because it is about shame and humiliation. And kind of a self-helpy book, or whatever. No, it was actually a political book, and it was about the difference between guilt and shame, and how actually in the West we use guilt as a tactic. That's, you know, the call out is about shame, but let's come back to how I said PTU uses his call outs. Call outs and cancel culture is actually, it's a very, very, very effective mechanism of social change. PTU uses it effectively against politicians and landlords. The left uses it effectively against our own and changes, you know, and that's why we can't have nice things. But the nonprofits and like neoliberalism uses guilt, and that's individualized again. I'm this privileged white person and I'm overwhelmed by how bad things are in the world. Who can I write a check to, right? Mm-hmm. And they just write a check, and then, you know, they've renewed their membership to the NAACP or the ACLU or whatever it is, and they're good white
allies. What politician can I write a letter to?
Yeah, exactly. It is an incredibly great analysis. It lacks a Marxist analysis. It lacks a real, she's an environmentalist and is coming at it from how we have screwed up the environmental movement by focusing on individual guilt and choices. Like her example is the dolphin safe tuna. That was like where she kind of learned politics and how we didn't make it so that the nets that catch dolphins are illegal so that no more dolphins die. We just labeled the tuna where dolphins don't get killed. You can still buy the tuna that kills dolphins.
Yeah.
And so it's just up to the individual consumer.
That's right.
And we don't, you know, we're not using shame for institutions anymore. We are using individual guilt and saying, hey, if we're ever going to change anything, it's only if you are going to recycle. It's only if
you are going to
have a Toyota Prius. It's only if you are going to not go to Walmart, right?
And to put it in an obscure perspective from the working musician perspective, we are constantly hearing on the mainstream media, if you think Spotify is an exploitative corporation, then don't have it on your phone and buy music instead. Well, no, the problem is that Spotify exists. The problem isn't that people choose to use it. It's dominated the market just like Uber has. It's like, if you don't like Uber, take a taxi. Well, there are no more taxis.
Well, right. And it's, and you know, and shaming people for going to Walmart when they're poor and that is the only chance they have to get Christmas presents for their friends. Look,
other stores are gone anyway. I mean, Walmart made sure to put them all out of business. So what are you going to do? Shop at some fancy place that charges three times as much? No, of course you're going to go to Walmart.
We're going to Walmart. Attack Walmart.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Unionize Walmart. Do mass boycotts of Walmart or something. But don't you dare tell that like poor single mom going in there to get a TV on sale so that her kids can watch cartoons in the morning while she sleeps in, that she is like the problem, you know? Yes. No, she's not. And that's what that book is about. And I just think we have a lot to learn.
And what's the book again? What was it?
Is Shame Necessary?
Great. Yeah. Excellent.
And I gave it to one of my Marxist mentors and political mentors who normally, I don't I generally feel like I can't recommend a book to him that he hasn't either already read or that would possibly teach him something he doesn't know. Mm-hmm. And he said it was a really good book. So it,
Excellent. Margot Black, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Sorry that I rambled.
No, that was exactly what I was hoping for. Next time we'll get more targeted rambling on all the members of the Portland City Council. I think that would be a good discussion, especially for KBOO.
The election for my race is August 11th, so we have to. Dan Ryan can't win, David.
What's this?
Dan Ryan can't win. The seat I was running for, is a runoff between Loretta Smith and Dan Ryan. Mm. And I'm going to endorse Loretta Smith, which I find surprising, but I'm actually feeling really good about it. And Dan Ryan is an amalgamation of Ted Wheeler and Dan Saltzman. When I said we need to tax the rich, he said, let's not do class war. We're all in this together.
Oh, yeah, right. When you're losing the class war, then they can tell you that we're all in this together.
Yeah. David, everybody's hurting right now.
Oh, yeah. Even the rich. Yeah. Even though they're getting richer, they're still hurting somehow, even with their private swimming pools and their own tennis courts and stuff.
You know. Have you ever lost $1 billion? Do you know how that feels?
So painful.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Anyway, no to Dan Ryan, yes to Loretta Smith. Maybe we'll talk about that next time.
Sure. Good, good. Okay. Thank you, Margot. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
And thanks for tuning in to this conversation with Margot Black. You can find this and other discussions with David in archived form in various locations, such as the Discussions with David playlist on youtube.com/drovics, at patreon.com/davidrovics, at soundcloud.com/davidrovics, and on any podcasting platform if you search for the podcast This Week with David Rovics. My latest album, Notes from a Failed State, is now up on Spotify and all the other usual music streaming platforms. The music, the live stream broadcasts, and the podcasts are all free, but if you want to support my journalistic and musical efforts, plus have access to some exclusive offerings just for patrons, please join my Community Supported Art Program, or CSA, at davidrovics.com/subscribe or patreon.com/davidrovics. Artists for Rent Control is now set up to start organizing an emergency eviction response team. Please go to artistsforrentcontrol.org and sign up. Hope to see you again soon here in the Matrix and out on the streets. Don't pay the rent and don't be afraid of your neighbors. Mutual aid will get us through. Bye for now.